Hello and welcome to our first podcast on the ISB's Conceptual Framework Project. My name is Rachel Nubley and I'm a member of staff here at the ISB. I'm joined today by Stephen Cooper, an ISB board member, and Peter Clark, Director of Research here at the ISB. In May of this year, the ISB decided to restart the Conceptual Framework Project that had been suspended in November 2010. Our aim is to finalise the revised conceptual framework by September 2015. To achieve this, we plan to issue a discussion paper in July of next year. Decision-making sessions on a draft discussion paper will start in February. During the December 2012 board meeting, the ISB held education sessions on measurement concepts and the boundary between liabilities and equity. As these sessions were education sessions, no decisions were made. The purpose of this podcast is to provide an overview of the discussions at the December 2012 board meeting. We'll start off by talking about measurement. Peter, could you provide us with an overview of the topics covered in the section on measurement?
Yes, thanks, Rachel. I think there are four main areas we covered in the measurement section. The first was whether we should have a single measurement basis for all assets and liabilities, or whether we should have different measurements for different circumstances. And in general, the direction of the discussion was that we probably shouldn't aim for a single measurement basis for everything, but that we should vary by circumstances. We looked at three different types of measurement, families of measurement basis, if you like. The first were cost-based measurements, which would start initially at the cost of the asset that's been acquired or of the liability that's been incurred. And then subsequently, as the asset, for example, is being used, it would be depreciated. It would also be subject to an impairment test. In the case of the liability, as you satisfy the obligation, it would be reduced. And it would also be subject to what's normally called an onerous test or a liability adequacy test, which would increase the measurement if the cash flows are greater than the current measurement. So that was the first type of measurement basis, a cost-based measurement. The second type we looked at were current measurements, and those you can think of as measurements that are updated in all respect for current circumstances. And we identified various varieties or subfamilies, if you like, within the current measurement family. Some of them are based on a market participant perspective, for example, fair value or fair value less cost to sell. Others are based on more of an entity-specific perspective, for example, value in use. And I think if we were looking at how to give guidance on when to use each basis, we might not necessarily select a single type of measurement within that current measurement family, but again, we might consider using different ones for different circumstances. The third family of measurements we looked at were ones that we called mixed, and those are the ones that are updated in some respects and not updated in others. And two examples we cited during the discussion were amortized cost for financial instruments and when fair value hedge accounting is being used. For amortized cost, it uses updated estimates of the cash flows, but it uses an effective interest rate that's locked in at inception and isn't changed subsequently. In the case of fair value hedge accounting, the measurement of the hedged item is remeasured for changes in the hedged risk, but isn't remeasured for other aspects of the measurement. So those were the three categories of measurement families, I've called them. We looked then at what sort of guidance we might give on when to use each type of measure. And we didn't really try and come up with hard and fast rules for these, but we gave some indicators of when each one might be more likely to be more appropriate. So examples that might indicate when a cost-based measure is likely to be more appropriate is, for example, when consumption of service potential is very important and is the most relevant information to users. That might be the case, for example, for a machine that's being used in a production process. More generally, if you have an asset that's being used together with other assets in a process, then again, perhaps a cost-based measure you might be more likely to conclude that cost-based measure is more appropriate. But as I said, no hard and fast rules really, but more indicators of when might be more appropriate. You might be more inclined to use a cost-based measure when a current measure is not easily verifiable. That might be the case for some intangibles, for example. And also, of course, there are cost-benefit issues, and sometimes coming up with a current measurement may be expensive, maybe more costly, sometimes even coming up with cost-based measurement may be more costly as well because of allocations, for example. One final indicator we looked at is accounting mismatches, and there might be circumstances when it makes more sense to use one type of measurement or another because of the way that other assets and liabilities are used in as part of the same process of being measured. So I think it's not just a question of looking at the measurement of the individual asset or liability, but also about the measure of other assets and liabilities being used together with it. Another point I should have made, in fact, is that the guidance we're developing suggests that it's not just important to look at how the asset or liability is being measured, but also about what the change in the measure represents and what sort of information that might provide to users. So that was some of the thinking we had on when each type of measure might be used. The final area we looked at on measurement was whether initial and subsequent measurements should be the same. And in general, the suggestion was that it's better really to use the same type of measurement initially and subsequently, because otherwise there might be a discontinuity between the initial measurement and the subsequent measurement. For example, if you are using, let's say, an entry value on day one and an exit value on day two, then there would be a jump in the measurement on day two. And part of that would just reflect a change in the measurement basis, not a change in the underlying circumstances. I should qualify that, I suppose, in one respect, which is that in some cases, a current measurement is used on day one as a means of establishing a deemed cost. One example of that is in a business combination, when the fair value of the asset or liability acquired is used as its is deemed to be its cost, and it's used as its cost for subsequent measurement.
Thank you very much, Peter. Stephen, could you summarise for us the discussions the board had around the issue of whether there should be one measurement basis or many?
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. The board had an interesting discussion. I think it's the first time the board has really had an opportunity to discuss this conceptual issue as part of this framework project. Obviously, we had a number of discussions on measurement previously before the framework project was suspended. I think it's fair to say that there are different views, obviously, as always in this area. Some of the board members did support an objective of having a single measurement basis, which essentially then has to be a current value. You can't really realistically have a single measurement basis which is amortized cost. So some believe that we ought to do that, but realistically then accept that in many situations you may not be able to get there for cost-benefit reasons, practicabilities of measuring a current value. But I think it's fair to say that that was probably a minority of those that spoke. I think the majority of the board that spoke at the meeting supported a mixed measurement basis, so having some assets and liabilities measured on a current value basis, others perhaps on a mixed basis, as Peter was talking about, and others on a cost basis. And I think that's consistent with where the board has been recently in discussions on standards level issues. So in IFRS 9, we have some assets measured at fair value, others at amortized cost, which is in fact a mixed measurement, as Peter was saying. And then, of course, on the leasing project, we're proposing to recognize lease assets and liabilities, and these would be measured at cost, cost established on day one, but then the same accounting as we currently have for tangible fixed assets and for other types of financial liabilities. So the board, in terms of its recent decisions, has very much worked on the basis of a mixed measurement model. Of course, the difficulty is trying to decide when each should be used, and I think sort of Peter's given some insight into the the way in which we might be thinking, but there's clearly a lot more work to do in terms of developing that further.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'd now like to move us on to the discussion that the board had about the boundary between liabilities and equity. Peter, once again, could you provide us with an overview of the topics that were covered?
Yes, thanks, Rachel. We were focusing really on the boundary, if you like, between financial liabilities and equity instruments, and trying to see how the definition of a liability might tie in with that distinction that we try and make when we're trying to classify financial instruments. And perhaps I could start with the definitions we're using. The existing definition of a liability says that a liability is a present obligation of the entity arising from past events, the settlement of which is expected to result in an outflow from the entity of resources embodying economic benefits. Now, I think the important part of that definition is an obligation, and it's going to lead to an outflow of resources, of economic resources. And equity is defined as the residual interest in the assets of the entity after deducting all liabilities. Now, I think in trying to apply the existing definition, we've had a number of problems that we've encountered in trying to define or to classify financial instruments as either financial liabilities or equity. Both in the existing standard IAS 32 and also in our projects on financial instruments with characteristics of equity. And some of the issues there, I think, first of all, that project hasn't really even been using the definition of a liability that's in the framework. It doesn't really concentrate on whether there's an obligation. That's part of the classification scheme that's in IAS 32, but it's not the whole story. And there are lots of complications to do, for example, with contingent settlement provisions or how to account for exchanges of variable amounts of shares for fixed amounts of cash or for fixed amounts of shares for variable amounts of cash. Another issue is that the classification in the financial instrument standard IAS 32 isn't consistent with our share-based payment standard IFRS 2. And in fact, the definition IFRS 2 is more closely aligned with the framework. So that's generated a string of implementation issues for the interpretation committee to consider. Our project on financial instrument with characteristics of equity got quite close to issuing an exposure draft a couple of years ago, but it's proved very difficult to come up with something that looked like a principle-based classification because it was trying to cover several different aspects at once. And so the way we felt we might tackle this problem is by cutting the problem really into two different problems. I think the existing classification is trying to achieve more than one thing with a single definition. First of all, is there an obligation to transfer resources or not? And secondly, how do the various claims on the entity for different shareholders or different holders of equity instruments, how do they affect the different holders? And the way we're thinking of dealing with that is to break it down into two pieces. So as the basic liability definition would stay pretty much as it is, focusing on whether there's an obligation to transfer resources. And that would define also what goes through the income statement. Then the other batch of questions that the existing standard was trying to cover is to do with cases where an entity has more than one type of equity instrument in existence. And a lot of the problem there has come from the fact that equity instruments are not remeasured. They're measured initially when they're issued, but they're not subsequently remeasured. And the area we're looking at is remeasuring those equity instruments, but not through profit and loss accounts, and not through other comprehensive income, but through the statement of changes in equity. What that would mean is that statement of changes in equity would need to be enhanced and upgraded to show these remeasurement effects. One way of thinking of those remeasurements is that they're a kind of wealth transfer between different classes of equity holder. And I think we would need to try and to enhance the format of the statement of changes in equity so that those wealth transfers become more visible and prominent, and also so that they're grouped together with appropriate subtotals, so that the holders of each class of equity can see what the effect is on them. So what that approach would mean is that the holders of each class of equity instrument would really receive two pieces of information. They'd receive information about the resources and obligations of the entire entity. So if an instrument creates liabilities, there would be liabilities recognised in the statement of financial position, and changes in that liability would be reported in comprehensive income. And then if there's an instrument that creates no liabilities, then you would only see the movements in equity, but you would see them in different columns of the statement of changes in equity. Now, as I said, we're exploring this idea. We've still got quite a few things to work out to see exactly how to develop it best, but that's the line we're exploring at the moment.
Thank you, Peter. The approach that we were exploring at the education session would continue to treat equity as a residual. Stephen, was everyone happy with the idea of continuing to treat equity as a residual?
I think those of us that have gone through the financial instruments with the characteristics of equity project that Peter described, which the board worked on for quite some time prior to suspending it a year or so ago, I think those of us that participated in that perhaps realised that trying to define equity and work from that is quite a difficult way of doing it. I mean, when we started that project, the initial proposals were to focus on equity as being essentially the common shares and then liabilities were everything else. And I think we soon realised that that was a difficult way to go. We proposed various alternative definitions of equity, went through a whole load of different approaches, and I don't think any really seemed to work that well. So I think many of us are pretty pleased that we go back to what we currently have and focus on the liability definition. Again, the board didn't take any decisions, this was an initial exploratory look at this particular area, but I think working with what we have at the moment and as Peter just says, to try and enhance it to make it more relevant to users, it may well be the way to go.
Thank you. Could you summarise for us the comments made on the proposal to make more use of the statement of changes in equity as Peter outlined earlier?
Yeah, I think this is very important. One of the issues that we need to focus on, I feel, in this area is not just that the balance sheet, is it a liability, is it equity? Because in a sense, that distinction is a little bit artificial because all of these instruments are claims on the business and they have different rights in terms of their access to the assets and the cash flows of that entity. But perhaps more importantly, it's all about measuring performance and about how those claims are going to interact and produce gains and losses for the business. So I'm personally very supportive of us exploring what Peter is talking about. I think we have problems at the moment in this area in focusing just on profit or loss. For example, we have the difficulty of how to deal with other comprehensive income. We have transactions between different groups of equity investors, maybe transactions with the minority shareholders. At the moment, we don't book gains and losses in the income statement because those are deemed transactions between equity investors. And many people find this puzzling that you might sell, that you might have a transaction with these minority shareholders, you might sell a minority stake in a business and you don't actually end up with a gain or loss in the income statement. And I think what Peter's describing is to try and provide a more rich information set reflecting the consequences of these types of transactions. Now, it's early stages and exactly what we end up with, I don't know. But I certainly think it's really important that we explore the different ways in which these types of changes in the claims are reflected within financial statements as a whole.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to both of you, Stephen and Peter. This concludes our podcast on the December Ed Sessions. Thank you very much for listening.